Committee on Revenue will come to order. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3632. Chris?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3632 touches the VETSI program and directs the department to give the greatest priority to projects that facilitate the distribution of compressed natural gas. At the end of the bill, there are a number of things that it directs the State Department of Energy to do, basically advertising and promoting the use of compressed natural gas.
Gentlemen.
Chair Barnhart, co-chair Berger, members of the committee. Cliff Vance, State Representative, District 60, and joined this morning by Representative Reed. We bring you House Bill 3632 as a attempt to start a conversation about the need to make more fuel available to Oregonians. And I'm hoping that the handouts that you are looking at reflect for all of you just an article. Actually, I'm going to turn to the first handout, which is an article from today's Statesman Journal, where the economists temper the forecast, and it says, most of the 38 economists who reduced their estimates pointed to higher oil and gasoline prices primarily, as well as rising food and other commodity costs. Nationwide, regular unleaded averaged $3.85 Friday, about 75 cents since early January. I just drove back from Ontario yesterday and had an opportunity to personally look at the price of fuel across the state of Oregon. It's all in the $4.05 range. The concern is, of course, that we have a nascent economic recovery that's going to be nipped in the bud by high fuel costs. Our previous governor, formed a alternative fuel vehicle infrastructure working group that reported back in January of 2010, and I've given everyone a copy of this, and it presents a compressed natural gas discussion and recommendations, a portion of which are caught up in the bill that's before us today. The concept, of course, is built upon the cost of natural gas, which is dramatically less than gasoline. So if you look at the handout that says making low-cost alternative fuels available to Oregon, you'll see that the current cost is around $1.25 a gallon. There's a 50-cent tax credit on top of that, so it drops the cost of fuel to 75 cents. If we turn to the people in the state of Oregon and said, we can supply you with 75 cent a gallon fuel, we would all be heroes. And so the hope of this bill is to start this or continue this conversation, because it was already started by our former governor and by the folks that worked on the alternative fuel task force. This bill, we struggled with how best to approach this, and we put into it a proposal that the BETSI be focused upon, the Business Energy Tax Credit be focused in some sense on natural gas. Frankly, that's drawn some attention I'd rather it hadn't from the propane folks, and I apologize to them, because my hope here is not to damage any other fuel. It's to make available other fuels. And this particular concept of making fuel available is built on the concern I have over the psychological aspect of higher fuel costs. Because when you go to a small town like Burns, as I did, and you talk to people, they'll say, gosh, we're not spending money because we're scared to death of fuel going to $6.50, which I actually heard on the radio as I was going across the state yesterday, fear that gasoline will go to $6. And that fear that not going to be able to afford the fuel to drive to work tomorrow is going to damage our economy severely, and I think has already started to do exactly that, and the economists, of course, reflected in this article, agree. So one of the biggest positives about this bill is that we send a signal to the people of Oregon that we are actually trying to do something, and more importantly, that there are alternative fuels available, and as gasoline creeps higher, and it will, by the way, continue to creep higher, if for no other reason because of our exchange rate. As you know, as our dollar weakens, fuel prices will go up, and our dollar most assuredly is going to continue to weaken, absent some another unfortunate blow to our nation or economy, such as we suffered a couple of years ago. I think that is going to by itself cause fuel prices to go higher. So the hope of this bill is that we can say to Oregonians, look, we are doing something about this. We are focusing our tax credit discussion on the possibility of conversion to natural gas, and we are focusing our discussion on making available other fuels. One of the big numbers, which I call out on the first page of our outline, is that we in Oregon spend $8 billion a year on fuel, $8 billion. And if we can switch over, of course we can't overnight, we would save half of that. I don't know how many things we're going to do in this legislative body this year that's going to make $4 billion worth of difference. But this one actually has that possibility if we could migrate in that direction. The concept, one element that you've heard about before, I think last week, is that to get this compressed natural gas out into the community was to convert our school bus fleet in every town, at least partially, to compressed natural gas. And this would then make available that type of fuel to folks in these smaller communities. If you look at the report that was created by our Alternative Fuel Vehicle Infrastructure Working Group, you'll see that the main problem is that we don't have this fuel available out in our state. So how can we make that happen? I felt a little unhappy about some of the attention that our discussion on school buses attracted, because I was really interested only in making an arrangement to have that type of fuel available in these communities. And the school bus seemed to be a logical, if you'll forgive the pun, vehicle for doing that. And so my hope has been that maybe we can modify the Cool Schools bill in a way that makes it more attractive to those interested in other elements or issues that go along with school buses, and achieve my underlying goal, which is to have natural gas available in communities. I want to go back to the propane for a minute. The propane is a perfectly fine fuel. We are trying to find the data on the conversion of propane. I think our mechanics are telling us that if you have a vehicle that can operate on natural gas, it's very simple to convert it to work on propane and vice versa. And simple in the sense of less expensive. I don't have the data to back that up yet. I'm hoping it's the truth, but maybe we'll hear about that later today. The other good thing about propane is it currently is available at almost every service station across Oregon, whereas compressed natural gas is not. And so, again, in keeping in mind that the key value of this exercise is making alternative fuels available, alternative, then this focus on natural gas is to get it out there also. And the school bus idea would do this. And so the main purpose today is to start this continue the conversation. We've done a lot of work in my office, my team, in putting together the materials you have in front of you. You can see that the cost savings is astounding. And I think we'll hear some testimony, I hope, a little later from folks that would suggest that just on today's fuel prices, if they don't go any higher, you could pay for the conversion of your automobile in about a year and a half or less. And every time it goes up by another dollar, every time gasoline does, the cost of converting your automobile over time drops. And so with that, I'm looking forward to hearing what other folks have to say. And I hope Representative Reed, your positive influence on this bill, since I put your name on it, knowing full well that you would support, having to drive from Portland every day, support less expensive fuel.
Absolutely. Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm reminded of what the great Mo Udall once said, everything that needs to be said has been said, not everyone has said it. So I will spare you a repetition of the great things Representative Benz said. I think there is great opportunity here to continue the conversation. I'm looking forward to that.
And that is Representative Tobias Reed.
That's right. Sorry.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Representative Benz, if I understand your intention clearly, I'm going to make a statement, and you can correct me where I go errant. The intent of this bill is to help provide a transition to a cleaner, more cost-effective, cheaper form of energy, especially around school districts, fleet vehicles, and that this bill is a step towards setting up the infrastructure that would be necessary to support those conversions, and that there are other places where we're looking at how we're incenting or creating opportunities for or financing those conversions. Is that correct?
That is correct. I'm sorry. Co-Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Berger, Representative Bailey. That is correct. And just to build on that just a bit, this idea of conversion to natural gas is not new. And that's why on one of the handouts you'll see that a number of fleets are already converting. The one that I think is newest is waste management in Portland. So these folks, these businesses have seen the savings. They're starting the conversion as we speak. I think that we would be building on a process that's already started and showing the people in the state of Oregon that there is hope, notwithstanding $4 or $5, $6 gasoline, that there is an alternative, and this is one of them. It's interesting to look at what the task force did. They identify a series of different alternatives, electricity being one, but we're some distance from electricity, and we could be 5, 10, 15 years out. So this would be an interim bridge device to get us closer to a cleaner future. I might also point out, though, if we look at how our current systems are, where our electricity comes from, much of it is coming from natural gas. And so in sort of an odd way, this may anticipate, may utilize the very same fuel in our cars that we may be otherwise using with electricity. I mean, it's an interesting concept to think through, but my hope is that this will at least give folks that are out there scared to death about these fuel prices knowledge that there is an alternative, because there is. Long answer.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You
appreciate your testimony. Jim Anderson and Gary Bauer.
Thank you, Co-Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Berger, members of the committee. I'm Gary Bauer with Northwest Natural. Representative Bentz asked if we would come and share some information regarding natural gas vehicles with you this morning, and so we hope to do that. I'd like to start by saying that Northwest Natural supports diversifying the nation's transportation fuel portfolio, and by that I mean not just natural gas, but using electricity, electric hybrids, all-electric vehicles, biodiesel, clean diesel, ethanol, propane, natural gas, and maybe even hydrogen in the future. So there's a lot of different fuel sources out there and various applications for those. Natural gas is available. There are three natural gas distribution companies in the state. Northwest Natural is the largest. We serve the Willamette Valley. We go as far east as the Dalles, and we actually go down on the coast down to Coos Bay. The other two are Avista, Jim Anderson is here, as well as Cascade Natural Gas, which serves in the Central Oregon area. They're, from a supply standpoint, just to let you know, there are well over 100 years of supply at the current production levels. So natural gas is around, and it will continue to be around as a fuel in the future. There is the opportunity to look at biogas, which is considered a renewable gas. It's biomethane, where you actually take waste, whether it's from landfill products, animal waste, et cetera, and take the gas off of that. Currently, that's primarily being used to generate electricity, but it can be used also for fuel sources. We're looking at that. There are actually some tests going on in Europe at using that to fuel their buses over there. It's proven and reliable. It's been around as a transportation fuel for a number of years. I will admit that there were some early issues with some of the fleets and conversions in terms of power issues and maintenance issues with those. From what I've been able to understand, CNG engines are not as forgiving as a diesel engine. A CNG engine needs a more constant maintenance type pattern, where on a diesel, you can, particularly older diesel engines, you can let those go for quite a while. So I know that's been one issue that people have raised. There are currently 11 million natural gas vehicles in the world today operating. Only 110,000 are in the U.S., so it kind of tells you the difference between where the U.S. has been focused on its issues versus the rest of the world. It's currently, I would say, best used in a fleet format, and part of that is, as Representative Bentz mentioned, is just basically the fueling process. You need to have a source for that, and so fleets work well with that. There's currently transit buses, 11,000 of those are in use in the country today. Los Angeles, for example, just retired its last diesel bus this year and now has over 2,200 natural gas buses. School buses, a lot of what we call medium-duty vehicles, which can be trucks, lighter trucks, not your 18-wheelers. And we've experienced those. AT&T is going to shift 8,000 of their vans over to compressed natural gas. In Oregon, the Port of Portland's airport buses use compressed natural gas. Rogue Valley Transit, the state motor pool, has a number of passenger vehicles that are compressed natural gas. The problem that we have there is that basically when this started back in the 80s, 90s, it was kind of done under the Clean Cities Program, and the Clean Cities Program was designed to bring and improve the air quality in cities. There was a lot of conversion that took place in automobiles back then, but basically the price of fuel changed, and so the market kind of got soft in terms of that activity. And so I think today the only car manufacturer that's been approved to sell vehicles here in the United States is Honda, and they do a Civic that has compressed natural gas. We had a lot of our fleet on natural gas at one point. Salem Transit has some, although they've also been shifting over to some clean diesel buses. Wilsonville is in the process of purchasing some natural gas vehicles, and as was mentioned, garbage haulers. We probably have about 20 to 25 customers in our service area that are looking at moving their fleets over to natural gas. If they're quiet, they meet those issues. They, as was mentioned, the fuel costs are definitely lower than what you would pay for gasoline or diesel today. And they have a number of environmental benefits. They're much cleaner than traditional diesel and gasoline. And I think there's one phrase that's actually in the State of Oregon report that says if you just converted one refuse truck to clean natural gas, you would be equivalent of taking 325 cars off the road in terms of environmental impact. We're not here suggesting that there are a lot of, well, let me start it this way. There are a lot of good uses for the Betsy, and we actually use those for a lot of different things, including looking at biomethane. So we're not really taking a position on whether or not this ought to be the highest and best use of, for the Betsy program, and I think a lot of my friends in the audience would have an opinion on that. But we do think that the bill could assist schools in analyzing how to reduce their transportation budgets, analyzing what the appropriate fueling options are, whether or not they could partner with neighboring organizations such as a refuse or anybody else that has a fleet operation to address the fueling issues, what the appropriate funding mechanisms are. There are a number of different mechanisms that can be used both federally as well as maybe some state funding. And also just, again, determining whether or not you could open up the natural gas infrastructure and fueling system to others to use. There are some issues with that that have been raised off and on over the years. And as a result, in Oregon, they pretty much shut most of those down for public use. California has a lot of them that are open to the public. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Co-Chair Berger, I'm Jim Anderson with the Avista Corporation. Avista is a natural gas serving utility in southwest and eastern Oregon with just short of 100,000 customers. As Mr. Bauer and Representative Bentz outlined, the goal for House Bill 3632 is to promote the use of compressed natural gas, CNG, in commercial and publicly operated vehicles, and to educate the general public about CNG as a vehicle fuel, to make CNG a vehicle fuel more available and for the use of the general public. This bill brings another aspect to the use of energy fuels for Oregon's energy future debate. Trying to reach our state's carbon reduction goals by 2025 or 2050 is a laudable goal, but it's obviously not going to happen overnight. Since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, we have seen a gradual buildup of carbon output, and any reduction we achieve will occur over time and not immediately. This bill points to an important aspect of that span of time that we are faced with when trying to reduce the carbon output. CNG creates a bridge, which was mentioned earlier, that we can use until the day comes when we are free of crude oil products. We currently use and talk about using three fuels aside from gasoline and diesel for motor vehicles: electricity, hydrogen, and biofuels. Now we can expand that debate to the use of CNG. This is not a new argument. Hydrogen is a vehicle fuel, is still on the drawing board, and relatively new concept and very expensive. Biofuels are being used as an additive to gasoline today and are proving to have several drawbacks. Expensive to produce, not fully compatible with vehicle engines, and there is a controversy about taking away food product from human consumption. Electric vehicles are here today and being used on an ever-increasing scale. This seems to be the popular thinking and is taking us, but there are some things that need to be pointed out. First of all is the full life cycle analysis. This is a term currently being used, also known as cradle to grave or life cycle assessment. It is a technique used to identify the full environmental impact of all stages of a product. It is intended to prevent the narrowing of environmental concerns. So, for example, a full assessment of an electric automobile would have to include the impact of mining coal, if coal is used to generate, the transportation of that coal, the power generation itself, the distribution, and finally, the efficiency of the vehicle itself. Natural gas obviously has a much lower total energy impact from point of extraction, pipeline compressors, to the efficiency of the vehicle. If there were to look at a total carbon footprint of electric vehicles, the disparity to natural gas would be equally incredible. So obviously, direct use of natural gas is the best use of alternative transportation fuels as well. There are some statistics that are interesting when you look at the fuels. In a typical year of operation, a gasoline-powered car will produce about 6 tons of carbon. That same CNG-powered vehicle driven during the same year over the same route would produce about 0.5 ton of carbon. It is clear more focus needs to be given to the use of natural gas as a fuel for motor vehicles. Cost and cost efficiency is a factor when converting to CNG from gasoline, but the costs are reasonable, and at today's price of gasoline, it can be recovered in 12 to 18 months, maybe sooner if gas prices continue to increase. With that, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bauer and I will open ourselves wide for questions.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Well, thank you, gentlemen. You seem to have covered the entire subject. I have three people who indicated they're more than 100 miles from home. John Van Bogart, Randy Camp, Darren Engel. Would those three come up? John Van Bogart, Randy Camp, and Darren Engel. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good
morning.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, and members of the committee, good morning. My name is Darren Engel. I am the Director of Marketing for Blue Star Gas. Blue Star Gas is a family-owned corporation propane supplier that has been in business in the Pacific Northwest for over 70 years. We are in our third generation of ownership, and for 70 years we've been successfully delivering propane, providing jobs, and paying taxes in the Pacific Northwest. I reside in Grants Pass, and I have worked in the energy sector for 23 years. I currently serve as the National Vice Chairman of the Propane Education and Research Council's Residential and Commercial Advisory Committee. I am here today on behalf of Blue Star Gas to strongly oppose HB 3632. The bill before you today proposes to amend statutes ORS 469-195 and 469-167, which already promote the use of alternative fuels. These statutes were pioneering legislation and have enabled our Oregon Department of Energy to promote the efficient use of alternative energies and encourage their conservation. As long as all alternative fuels are able to compete on an even playing field, they will continue to achieve these goals. Although my employer is a propane supplier, it is clear to me that each alternative fuel has both advantages and disadvantages depending on their application, and I can elaborate further if you have questions on those. These fuels and their respective technologies will continue to develop and evolve as long as they're able to compete on their abilities and their effectiveness. If special interest is given, it will be at the expense of the environment, the economy, and the electorate. This bill does more than just start a conversation. HB 3632 solely promotes natural gas and disadvantages any and every other option. The bill crowns natural gas as the winner of the alt fuels and gives its first place priority status in any application where it could be used and not just where it is the best choice. If enacted as written, this bill could leave vehicle fleets, schools, and Oregonians with a one-fuel-fits-all solution, and Oregon could be left with no alternative choices when it comes to alternative fuels. I draw your attention to Section 4 of this bill. Which further requires the use of taxpayer dollars for advertising the availability of compressed natural gas, for facilitating the awarding of loans for natural gas infrastructure, and for developing plans for conversion to natural gas of school bus fleets and transit agency fleets, whether they want to or not. This plan must encourage school districts and transit agencies to enter into long-term fuel supply contracts, regardless of whether or not they make the most environmental or economical sound fuel for that application. The impact of such favoritism will be astronomical to my industry, and it will benefit the state of Oregon minimally. Oregon is composed of mostly rural communities, and natural gas mains are not usually available off the natural gas grid. This built-in dysfunctionality will not benefit most of the citizens of Oregon and excuse the natural selection process and entrepreneurial spirit of the free market economy, and it will hinder the development of innovative products and technologies that the rest of the world are using. Currently, propane autogas is the number one alternative fuel used in the world. Nearly 16 million vehicles worldwide run on propane autogas. If this is bill advantaged only propane as it advantages natural gas, I would be here today to oppose this bill as well, because it's not best for free market economy. No single fuel is the best solution in every single application. It depends on the merits, and each fuel should be weighed on their merits. Our best hopes for the future that it will be served right if the right fuel is used in each application where it is the best alternative. All alternative fuels should compete on an even playing field where market position is not driven by market manipulation, but instead they're based on their merits, such as performance, environmental benefits, and economical advantage. I believe that purpose will best be served if you vote no on this fuel favoritism bill. Thank you for your time, and I'm available to answer questions if you have any.
Thank you very much. Gentlemen.
Co-chairs and committee members, I'm Randy Camp, and I apologize if I check the wrong box because I'm not 100 miles away. I'm from Corvallis. And House Bill 3632 focuses on natural gas to the detriment of propane, which is actually a derivative of natural gas. And in the Pacific Northwest, the majority of propane sold comes from natural gas, not oil, which is its other source. Majority of the gas that I sell is from natural gas. As demand for natural gas increases, the production of propane would also increase. Therefore, with the new natural gas projects in the United States, such as shale gas and our Marcellus Rains, and etc., we can expect propane supply from natural gas to increase as well. Under federal law, propane is defined as a clean alternative fuel propane and natural gas, which you've heard a little bit about earlier. Propane and natural gas fleets are virtually the same in terms of greenhouse gases emissions. So it only makes sense if you're looking at natural gas as an alternative fuel in Oregon to also consider propane. Many propane dealers in the state of Oregon are small businesses, while natural gas companies are large utilities. My company is one of those small businesses. We cover from the north, from Salem, south to Eugene, from the west Oregon coast to the central desert of central Oregon, out of two offices, one in Corvallis and one in Redmond. We are an Oregon-owned and operated company, so money spent with us stays in the state of Oregon. Why should government focus solely on large utilities at the expense of small retailers like myself? Also, customers of small businesses, when propane is a clean alternative fuel as well, it is a detriment to all alternative fuels, as Darren mentioned, not to be part of a bill such as this. You also need to take a look at the entire state of Oregon, which by and large is made up of rural communities, and in many cases not even served by natural gas lines. CNG refueling stations must be built on natural gas lines. Conversely, propane refueling stations can be built anywhere, rural communities, suburban entities, or even metro situations. With many Oregon communities outside of the gas mains, propane is a much more practical use on a state like ours. I believe it is in the best interest of Oregon and its residents to have propane considered if you move forward with an issue like this. If you have any questions, again, I'll be here to answer them for you.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Good morning. My name is John Van Bogart, and I'm with Public Solutions Group, and I've worked within the alternative fuels industry for over 15 years, building and managing refueling infrastructure and promoting alternative fuels and alternative fuel vehicles. I'm currently the vice chair of the Central Coast Clean Cities Coalition in California, and I have participated on several industry working groups with the California Energy Commission and the U.S. Department of Energy. My current role with PSG, I provide services to fleets that are interested in converting to alternative fuels. These services include comprehensive fleet analysis for their existing vehicles, refueling infrastructure, current fuel types, fuel consumption, duty cycles, and development of a comprehensive fleet emission baseline. I'm here today to give a neutral overview of alternative fuels and advanced vehicle technologies and answer any questions the committee may have. With more than 50 years of collective personal and staff experience, PSG has assisted fleets in their development of long-term, fiscally responsible alternative transportation programs, providing unbiased recommendations, grant writing, and bid spec analysis. Typically, we find that fleets are favoring one fuel over another because they've been sold by an industry professional that is the fuel for their fleet. Oftentimes, they're unfamiliar with the ever-changing world of alternative fuels and vehicle technologies. PSG believes that no one person or entity will have more current knowledge or advanced proven technology than the experienced industry experts who are continually implementing, operating, and deploying those strategies within their marketplace because they have harsh consequences when they do the wrong thing. This is why PSG incorporates these ideas and thoughts in these individuals in our research and analysis. The result is a comprehensive fleet program that saves money for the fleets and helps them operate in their environment. For your view, I have submitted some detailed information for our technical and environmental summary of specified alternative fuel options and our first fleet product. These documents are part of a larger program that we use when working with various clients to educate them on the menu of alternative fuel options as part of their comprehensive fleet analysis. I do want to clarify that the 2011 and 2012 versions of these documents will be updated shortly, and we'll have more vehicle options for fuels such as propane, plug-in electric hybrid, and hydraulic hybrid options. Upon request, I will provide this committee with the updated version of those reports. In view of the short time that we have here today, I wanted to focus on the single most important issue that remains constant in dealing with fleet operations of any size, and that is there are no silver bullets within the transportation fuels industry, and that the freedom of choice is oftentimes the key element in determining the most effective fuels and vehicle technologies for stable and sustainable fleet operations. Said differently, the lack of fuel and vehicle choices are one of the many lessons learned from our current near total dependence on petroleum fuels such as gasoline and diesel. Supporting a diverse portfolio of alternative fuels and vehicle technologies not only lowers the risk of additional dependence on a single currently available alternative, it also familiarizes fleets with real-world experience to quantify expected cost savings and evaluate new technologies. More importantly, fleets are diverse in their makeup and in their mission, and each subfleet performs different functions and has different duty cycles. While one fuel may be more cost-effective for heavy-duty vehicle applications, that same fuel may be not available or cost-prohibitive or even unrealistic for their light-duty fleet applications. In addition, if fleets are limited to specific alternative fuel or vehicle type, they will be more vulnerable to price spikes, supply shortages, and fluctuating economic conditions. Fleets need to have choices and options to be successful. Industry interests perform best when they have to compete for market share. Additionally, fleets and consumers are best served when policymakers do not choose winners and losers. The most successful programs to accelerate widespread usage of alternatives and diverse vehicle applications are ones that have choice and opportunity for fleets. Supporting a portfolio of alternatives not only creates a hedge against unforeseen interruptions, it also allows fleets to choose the most cost-effective fuel and technology to displace gasoline and diesel, reduce emissions, and build a sustainable fleet. Thank you for your time, and I'll have any questions you might have.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Berger?
Yes. A couple of technical questions, if you will, for someone who's not familiar with propane. Somebody mentioned propane autogas. Is that different than propane gas? Is there different types of propane?
Co-chairs and members of Representative Berger, propane autogas is what they call it everywhere else in the world. They don't call it propane. They simply call it autogas because they use it for their autos. And so that's how it's known in the rest of the world.
But it's the same thing that I see in tanks behind service station.
Exact same, yes.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Brewer.
Thank you. We have seen public bodies some lists of public bodies and private companies that already use natural gas. Can you discuss the current users and fleets and school districts and so on and so forth that use propane currently?
Portland Elementary School District has operated propane in their school bus fleet for quite a number of years, I think more than 20-some years, and they can testify of the millions of dollars they've saved alone on fuel costs. One thing about school buses, a CNG school bus is only available in a transit, which is the larger style bus. The conventional or smaller buses, they're not available currently in natural gas from an OEM supplier. So smaller fleets or special needs, which is one of the fastest growing elements of the school bus industry, propane is really the only OEM direct alternative fuel option. Consequently, propane provides the cleanest school bus made in the United States today. There are other fleets. LA Unified has over, between them and their contractors, they operate over 500 propane school buses. The state of Texas, a client of mine has sold about 500 buses in the last 2 years. They have, I believe, about 4,000 buses in the state of Texas. So there are quite a number of school districts that have run propane nationwide, mainly because of its cost effectiveness, low cost of vehicle conversion, and low cost of infrastructure.
Co-chairs and Representative Brewer, if I could elaborate on that.
Please.
We also have several municipalities that are using propane auto gas for their police fleets, for their sheriff's vehicles. It is a great mobile fuel for that application as well. We're in contract with several other of the transportation agencies that are looking at converting their Ford pickups. Propane is an excellent solution for light and medium-duty vehicles. Again, CNG is a great solution for heavy-duty. Not one particular alt fuel fits every single need and application.
Thank you. Other questions? One of the offers that you made in your presentation was to give us the updated first steps when it became available. I think we would appreciate having that.
Yes, because there's been quite a few developments in just the last 18 months with vehicle manufacturers. General Motors has come to the table, and they are producing now OEM propane and CNG vehicles factory direct, which is a substantial development in alternative fuels to have an OEM supplier that size come to the table.
Okay, now, in the fleet situations that you generally work in, I take it that fuel availability is probably less of an issue than it would be for a private individual trying to fuel a private passenger car because of the reality that vehicles return to a central spot at night and refuel. What kind of effort would it take for a state like Oregon to have natural gas available around the state, as you understand the issue?
You're correct. And a lot of fleet operations are hub and spoke, where the vehicles come back to a central location. As far as natural gas, you have to be on the natural gas grid available to a pipeline. There are situations where they can truck it in, but that's extremely expensive when you've got to compress natural gas, put it on a transport, and then truck that vehicle into a rural market. In the metropolitan areas, there's a lot of natural gas pipelines, and stations can be built rather easily. The footprint is a lot bigger than, say, a propane or a gasoline or diesel-style dispenser because of the compressors and things that you need to have. Developing natural gas in the metropolitan areas is probably more feasible than it would be in the rural areas. I don't see that in rural areas is an area where we would take a fleet and recommend that that avenue. Propane can be easily trucked anywhere, transport or on a bobtail. Propane companies have what they call a plant where their central distribution, they buy it from a rack, they bring it to their distribution, they have storage spread out in their market area, and then bobtails, smaller delivery trucks, medium-duty trucks, carry around 3,000 gallons, and those vehicles can be driven anywhere where fueling infrastructure can be set up. A lot of companies that deal in really out-back type areas have smaller four-wheel drive vehicles that have 1,000, 2,000 gallon tanks, and they can get up on dirt roads and go up and fill storage tanks for motor fuel applications, also heating fuel and things of that nature. So when you look at a fleet, when we look at a fleet, we take a look at everything. What current infrastructure they have in place now, how that can be augmented to an alternative fuel source, and what vehicles are available in their fleet lineup. If they have heavy-duty, light-duty vehicles, we try and find the best niche and most sustainable for them. It's easy to implement and cost-effective. When it comes to grant funding to buy down some of these, people say, hey, well, you know, the grant money's free so we can implement the program. Well, grant money really isn't free. These are taxpayer dollars, and so we have to be the best stewards of those as a consultant to our client in offering recommendations to them on which fuel choice to go for.
Thank you.
Chairman Barnhart, yes. As an example, a typical propane refueling infrastructure would cost about $25,000 to install at a facility, at a school bus yard or something like that, where they would have 10 or 11 or 12 buses. In comparison, a natural gas refueling station would start at $400,000 and go up from there. So the cost is quite different when you're looking at the different fueling infrastructure and the amount of money required to do that.
And can any of the three of you give us the sort of short version of why that is? I mean, I think I know, but I'm not certain. I remember, you're talking to the lawyer psychologist. I don't know much about physics. But I do understand that methane and propane are very, very different in their physical properties. Could you describe a little bit how that impacts what you've just described?
Absolutely. Chairman Barnhart, my education is in cooking, so I know chemical compounds when it comes to taste. But so when it comes to propane, propane is a liquid stored under pressure. So propane is a liquid by its natural properties. Natural gas is a gas by its natural properties and must be compressed, CNG, to make it into a liquid form so it can be used in a vehicle application. That compression and the equipment required to do so takes that gas and compresses it to 3,500 PSI, and then it converts back into a liquid so it can be loaded onto a vehicle. The cost associated with that is why those costs are so much higher.
Thank you, and I'm getting head nods from the others. Yeah. That helps. So I need less equipment, lighter tanks, and so forth to handle propane than I would for handling the predominant methane of natural gas.
Absolutely, and technically, you can actually transfer propane as a liquid just without a pump and a motor. The time process would be longer, but it will actually transfer without a pump and a motor involved because it's a liquid being transferred across.
Thank you. Representative Berger?
I just wanted to check. Was my understanding somewhere in there that propane works better on smaller buses and the gas, natural gas for bigger? No?
Mainly because of the engine applications. When you get into heavy-duty Class A trucks, transit buses, things of that nature, it requires a larger engine. Currently, CNG has the only alternative fuel engine in that classification
that would be
55,000 pounds, something like that.
I didn't want to belabor this. I just wanted to get that.
In light and medium-duty applications, it really depends on the fleet. Pickup trucks is a great application for both fuels. If they have a long, if vehicle range is an issue, we favor propane more because you virtually replace the gasoline tank with the propane tank. With the CNG tank, oftentimes if they have to travel quite a distance, they have to use the bed of the truck for the fuel tank to get the same amount of range. I guess an easy way to explain it, if you looked at the energy value of the fuels, diesel has 135,000 BTUs per gasoline gallon equivalent. Let's just say 10 gallons.
Sir, you're getting into too much information.
My
question was answered in the first sentence.
Yeah, I do think that we got a lot of that information, and I think much of the information that you're just talking about is described in the literature that you've given us, and I'll give that to the committee to review. Are there other questions for this panel? Gentlemen, we thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very much appreciate your testimony this morning and the clear explanations. And now I've got to find my sheet, which I have managed to bury somewhere.
This is your agenda.
Yeah, but I need to find the witness sheet.
Oh, there it is.
It's buried under all of the material that I've received. Let's hear from Joe Westby, Alan Pollock. And then, Bob, you're on deck. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard this morning on this bill? Okay, why don't you come up now? Gentlemen, please.
Co-Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Berger, members of the committee, my name is Joe Westby. I'm with Feral Gas Propane. I've been with Feral Gas for 20 years now, and I've worked in the propane industry for 22. I'm here today to help discuss some of the issues and benefits of propane versus the CNG debate that we've been going over this morning. I'll try not to repeat myself or reiterate everything that was just said by my industry partnership there. We are the suppliers for the Portland School District, and we've partnered with them for a number of years now. Our industry has made great strides and has developed great partnerships with companies like Roush and Bluebird to push forward the auto gas industry and provide people with a great alternative source for auto gas when up against gasoline and diesel. Some of the more recent partners that we've worked with have been the Ben Lapine School District, the Byrne School District, and the Redmond Madras School District. We are also working with McMinnville. The Ben Lapine School District is a recent partner of ours, has been for at least the last year. They did their homework. They had the chance to review other fuels. Natural gas was one of them. In their statement attached to the written forms in front of you, you'll see that their reasoning was propane is clean and abundantly available. Propane, the fueling infrastructure is straightforward. The fueling is quick. We're not dealing with the high pressures that you heard about earlier with CNG. Minimalistic pumps, minimalistic electricity is required for the movement of the fuel from the pumping station into the vehicle itself. The propane pressures run at a maximum of 300 PSI, not 3,600. When you're dealing with temperatures such as Bend, you can have mornings in the 20s and daytime highs in the 90s. This is a concern. Extended engine life and oil changes. Propane auto gas and propane vehicles have been around for a number of years. You also heard something earlier about the quirkiness of natural gas vehicles. Okay, because of our long-standing history, we've worked through a lot of that. The propane engines typically run three times longer than standard gasoline engines. Propane is also 99.9% particulate free. So this does everything that the school wanted to accomplish as far as the clean fuels go. The Portland School District is another one that continues to add to its fleet. They currently run a fleet of almost 400 buses. We've been very proud to partner with them. They've had multiple options throughout the years and, again, sit close enough to the natural gas infrastructure that they could choose that if they wanted to. Propane continually rises to the top of their list, though, as the preferred alternative fuel for their choice. The bill that we have before us right now is basically putting one over the other. And really, that's all we're asking is to be included in that, and that for many of our applications, propane is the preferred choice for our customers. We've worked hard to push the industry forward. We've worked hard to create the vehicles and create the relationships that make this a viable option for people that are looking to save money from gasoline and diesel with their fleets.
Thank you.
I ask you to oppose this, and I'll make myself available for questions. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. Please.
Thank you.
And if, to the extent you can, try not to repeat what other people have already said. We'd appreciate that.
Absolutely. Morning, Co-Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Berger, members of the committee. I am Alan Pollack, and I'm the general manager for Salem Area Mass Transit District. At the district, we advocate for the use and the choice of alternate modes of transportation. We also advocate the use and the choice of alternate fuels for our transit fleets. By way of background, the transit district, we currently operate a fleet of 64 transit buses. 34 of those are fueled by compressed natural gas, and 30 are fueled by biodiesel. We also own and operate our own fueling station that is linked with the direct pipeline from Northwest Natural Gas at our operations and maintenance facility. That facility is not open to the public, and it's not conducive to facilitate public access or retail sales. As I understand it, and I'm talking, and my comments will be on Section 4, where it states that the director of the State Department of Energy shall develop plans for school bus transit agency and garbage collection vehicle fleets to use vehicles run on compressed natural gas. And the plan in Section B would include programs to encourage those districts to enter into long-term supply contracts with private companies that will supply compressed natural gas fueling facilities open to the public. Our concerns are there center around that language and the unknown about whether or not that would require a facility such as ours, who already owns a fueling station, to then make that open to the public and or disregard that station and require us to receive our fuel from a public fueling facility. That has several concerns for us, specifically one of them, the security on our facility with the public coming in and out, as well as we advocate for the choice of having our fleet mixed. Right now, in the event of a natural disaster or some other catastrophic event, and one of those fuel sources, we lose that ability to gather from that fuel source, say either CNG or diesel, we would have at least half of our fleet right now the ability to operate for either evacuation or for contingency operations. While with a smaller fleet, it would allow us some options if one of the fleet or one of the fuel sources lost its ability to get to us. So for that, I would just wrap up. So we advocate and allow for the choice of fuels based on local conditions and local needs. And that concludes my testimony, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Charles with Cascade Policy Institute. Just like to make a brief comment based on a comment that Representative Bence made in his opening remarks with regard to the perceived pressure to, quote, do something. Because people, you go to town halls, people complain. I totally understand that there is pressure, and it's not very satisfying to say that in many of these cases, the appropriate thing is don't just do something, stand there. But that's what you need to do. Gasoline prices have fluctuated more or less randomly for the last 50 years. They will continue to fluctuate randomly. They're probably not going to go up to even $5 a gallon, let alone $6. It'll sort itself out. The number of moving parts in the energy economy that you're attempting to intervene into is vast, unknown. The number of unintended consequences, also vast and unknown. And personally, I know I'm not smart enough to figure out a way to intervene that would have net social benefits, and I think you have to approach this extremely cautiously and probably just accede to market forces, let all those entrepreneurs out there taking risks on their own dollars and investors' dollars do those things, and just back away because this could become a tar baby that you might wish you'd never gotten involved in. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Vance.
More of a comment, Mr. Chair. We're just checking on the price of propane versus natural gas across Oregon. We see that propane is selling here in Salem for $3.09, and in Medford, natural gas, one of the few places it's available, is $1.41. Perhaps they'd like to comment on that.
That really was a question I was going to get to. There have been a number of, and I should have asked the earlier panel too, but there have been a number of comments about the infrastructure. Does the fact that one costs a lot more than the other make any difference?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Bence, I'm not real familiar with where you may have pulled that price. I can tell you that for larger fleet, autogas right now, based upon the current market conditions, is running somewhere more along the lines of $2 a gallon, half the cost of gasoline and diesel. Something else I would like to add, too, is the infrastructure is cheaper, obviously 10 times cheaper than that of natural gas. And more often than not, it's the supplier that provides that infrastructure for the customer. In this case, we go in, we set it up for the schools, we maintain it, we take care of it, it's our baby. But this is also free market retail. Should my service, should my price, should anything about my company become undesirable for the customer, they have the option to choose another supplier. Oftentimes, we are very competitive with each other, and this protects the consumer and always puts them in a good situation for fuel cost.
Did I get at your issue?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I would just say the source of the 309 is Salem, Texaco. The CNG is the one station in Medford open to the public. So I'm simply saying the whole concern here is not to pick a winner. It's simply to make available the less expensive choice to Oregonians. Mr. Chair, the bill would be amended, so we are not picking winners. That's the last thing we want to do. And given the timing of this bill, we most assuredly will take that picking a winner piece out because we don't want that. What we do want is this particular type of fuel to be available to everybody in Oregon, just as propane already is. And so the challenge is to have more choices, not fewer. And to the extent the bill tries to pick a winner, it will be repaired.
Thank you. Thank you. Any other questions for this panel? Let's hear from Mr. Repine, and we have another hearing and several other pieces of business to do this morning. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, co-chairs, committee members. For the record, I am Bob Repine, acting director for the Department of Energy. I think the panels that you've had before you already have done a good job of laying out the pro- pros and cons, the likes and dislikes of what the bill offers in its written form. I would just like to just add a couple of things that have not been talked about, and I'll do that briefly. Under the current law, 469.010, the department or the assembly declares and finds that the state government shall provide a source of impartial and objective information in order that this energy policy may be enhanced. And so the agency historically has been running under this construct of impartial and objective information. So this bill does take an exception to the way that the current law is written. So if, as Representative Benz has just said, that the partiality might be taken out of it, but as it's written today, it is in conflict with kind of the driving language that directs the agency on conducting the business that we do on behalf of the people of Oregon. Currently, the agency participates in all forms of alternative fuels, including this one, and propane, and alternative fuel vehicles, and biodiesel, and anything else that is an option for citizens of Oregon today. So one of the things that I believe, and I think it'll bear out, as you've heard the numbers of each one of these industries that offer types of fuels for different type of vehicles, we're going to need all of them. We're going to need every vehicle that's manufactured outside of the typical fossil fuel vehicles that we are familiar with today to try to get to the place where we need to be so we're not as reliant on fossil fuels for our vehicles. And so I think having the current policy for the agency has been we welcome them all. We evaluate and award credits when appropriate for cars. We award loans for appropriate lending tools for installation of facilities that pump these fuels. And so we've treated that categorically all the same in the history of the department. And we would continue doing that as well. And if the bill does go forward, the other things that I would ask that the committee members consider is I would like to see when it talks about the advertising, that's something that the agency just generally doesn't do. But if there was an interest to have the agency do advertising in some way, we'd like to have it more articulated in a way so we know what the goal of the advertisement is to accomplish. And so we would look for some definitional opportunities there as well. Again, currently the department plays a role with these type of vehicles and or filling stations or charging stations all around the state. We bring them all under the tent. We treat them equally, and we offer all the same tools and financial opportunities for them today, and we would do that in the future. With that, Mr. Chair, I can conclude my statements.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Repine? Thank you very much, sir. We appreciate your testimony, and with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3632 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3640. We'll hear from Paul and then from Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3640 is a first public hearing. It requires licenses with the State Board of Tax Practitioners for facilitators of tax anticipation loans and repayment instruments. The bill specifies that what kind of information is required on interest rates, fees, and repayment terms. It also establishes a response to violations. On the back of your draft SMS, I did just put the governor's budget outline of the State Board of Tax Practitioners, just so you can see the overview and the size of the budgets that currently operate.
Ah, Senator Brewer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Representative Katie Air Brewer, House District 29, and I am one of the chief sponsors, along with Representative Tina Kotek and Senators Telfer and Dingfelder, for House Bill 3640. What this bill does, in general, is it provides disclosure clarification for folks coming in to prepare their tax, to have their tax return prepared by folks that are licensed tax practitioners or licensed tax consultants that are also also operating and offering refund anticipation loans and other types of products which keep evolving. This is asking for upfront disclosure on the cost of the return preparation as well as other types of costs if they enter into a financing vehicle, which clearly the refund anticipation loans and the refund anticipation checks and other vehicles which will come around do have elements of being a short-term loan, to offer those that disclosure upfront to the taxpayers coming in and also to lower lower the maximum interest rate charged on these vehicles to a maximum of 36%. Right now, some of those interest rates are as high as 500%, hovering around there, and various degrees of 0 to 500%. Fees are charged for a great many things, which we'll hear from other folks testifying on this as to what those fees are. And it impacts it targets some citizens that typically would not come in to see a CPA. You'll hear some conflict about how this is to benefit the CPAs. This is not anything to do with the CPA. As you know, I am a CPA. Much of the work done by certified public accountants has nothing to do with taxes. They provide a large segment of their businesses on assurance services, mergers and acquisition, consulting, estate planning, on and on and on, nothing to do with tax preparation. To the extent that certified public accountants do, in fact, offer tax preparation services, the model is entirely different, typically not involving any of these refund anticipation loans or products. That is not what they do, and they have a complete set of ethics that they must follow, independent, larger than what the tax practitioners and tax consultants follow, a whole separate paradigm of ethics. And so with that, I'd like to just leave that alone and move on to Representative Tina Kotek.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. For the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. It's a pleasure to be in front of the House Revenue Committee this morning, my first time this session. This is a revenue issue, and we're really pleased to have House Bill 3640 in front of you. You have my brief testimony. I'm not going to go through it, but I do want to point to the backside with the photos. I've been working on issues around tax fairness and protecting low-income taxpayers for quite a while. You'll see photos from my district, both from H&R Block and Jackson Hewitt, taken back in March before the tax season ended, of big posters advertising get your loan quicker and free and magic money all the way around. You see a refund anticipation check poster from H&R Block, pay nothing out of pocket, get your check now. And then we have Jackson Hewitt on the other side talking about refund anticipation loans. These products are out there. They're being marketed. I personally believe they're predatory. My co-sponsor mentioned, these are very high rates. We're just asking to put in a line with the rest of loan products out there, capping it at 36%. We want further disclosure of the fees. We want complete disclosure and not allowed to be charging additional fees to prepare these things. You work on a lot of tax credits here. You've talked about the earned income credit we have here in the state, the federal earned income tax credit. You'll notice on the Oregon Center for Public Policy has been publishing for several years now the amount of the EITC refunds that come into the state. I have about 5,000 families who have used EITC. These are from 2007. That's $8.5 million in federal funds. A chunk of that is going out for those folks who are using these rails and racks. They're paying a part of their refund, sometimes unknowingly. That money that we have put aside in those tax credits to support low-income families. This is a really important bill. You're going to hear from the industry that this isn't needed because there's been higher scrutiny from the IRS around these products and the lenders who allow them to come from some of these companies. I would submit that we don't know if these products are going away. They're too lucrative for them to go away, and we need to be ready for next tax preparation season. So we had a bill earlier on the Senate side. We're back on the House side. We obviously can't deal with this issue for this tax season, which is over, but we could do it for next year. So please, I hope you'll have a chance to listen to our experts who are up next, and we really thank you for hearing the bill today.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Sarah Holtzclaw, Amelia Martin, Robert Wagner. Angela Martin, sorry.
My bad penmanship this morning.
Well, and maybe I read it too quickly. Who knows? It does look like Angela now that I look at it a third time.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Angela Martin with Economic Fairness Oregon, a statewide consumer advocacy and economic fairness nonprofit.
Advocates at the state and national level have been working on this issue literally for years. Representative Kotek was modest when she says she's been working on this for a while, because I can recall her working on this prior to her being a member of this body. So it has been a debate going on for years, and progress has been made over those years. However, our progress has not kept pace with the changing business model and products that are currently being offered. And that's why I come before you in support of House Bill 3640. Let me start by giving a brief description of the products, because we throw around a lot of words that, frankly, didn't make much sense to me at first. A RAL, a loan against your anticipated refund. That means it will deliver your money to you faster, typically about 14 days faster than you would receive if you were just to get a refund directly from the IRS deposited to your account. By most accounts, the use of RALs are on the way out the door, thanks to changes at the federal level. And I'll talk about more about this in a little bit. They aren't gone, but the usage of them has declined considerably, being replaced by refund anticipation checks. A couple of things about a RAC. First off, a RAC delivers your money to you no faster. It does not get your money faster to you than the IRS would get it to you. A RAC is a temporary account that is set up on the behalf of the taxpayer. The IRS delivers the tax refund to that account. The taxpayer's fees for tax preparation, electronic filing, all those associated fees, including fees for the RAC, are deducted from that account, and the remainder is delivered to the taxpayer on either a paper check, which carries a fee, or a plastic debit card, which carries a fee. Let me speak briefly to what these fees typically are. Looking at one of the major chains, we see that a RAC starts with an account setup fee of $30.95. And then to receive that money from that account once the IRS delivers it, you will pay either $20 to receive a paper check, or you can receive a plastic debit card, which carries a usage fee of $2.50 every time you go to swipe it, plus any ATM fees that might be connected to that. Add all of that up. The benefit for deferring your $187 average tax preparation starts at $50 and goes up to $60 or more, depending on how many times you swipe that card. A considerable amount of money simply to get the benefit of $187 tax preparation fee deferred for 15 days. A couple other things I want to clarify. First off, the players, because there are three primary folks that we're talking about here. Obviously, the taxpayer. You've heard mentioned that recipients of RALs and RACs are disproportionately low-income workers, and the research bears out on this. A significant portion of their annual income is delivered through their tax refund, thanks to the earned income tax credit. Then you have the tax preparer. That is the individual that facilitates the loan. All of 3640 is directed at the tax preparer, and that is the individual that is licensed to operate and prepare taxes here in Oregon. Then the third group of folks are the lenders. Nothing about 3640 prevents the lender from making a RAL or a RAC or charging fees. As a matter of fact, the bill explicitly says that the facilitator can look at the fees that the lender would charge and pass that cost along to the taxpayer. So we're not regulating the lender's fees. We are speaking to what that tax facilitator does. The mention of the 36% interest rate cap, again, it looks to the tax facilitator and says it would be against Oregon state law to facilitate a loan beyond that 36% interest rate cap. It's been said that the state protections are not necessary because of the improvements that we've seen at the federal level. What I would say to that is I welcome the federal protections and changes that have been made. They are much needed, but they were all directed to refund anticipation loans. Again, we go back to the refund anticipation check. That is the growing product, and it is currently unregulated at the state or the federal level, and that's what we hope to see with 3640. This bill would increase oversight by requiring RAL and RAC facilitators to register with the Oregon Board of Tax Preparation or Tax Preparers. It would protect Oregonians' tax refunds by prohibiting those add-on fees that the facilitators charge. And it would increase transparency. This would come with improved disclosures regarding the cost of the tax preparation products and services. This bill requires that if you're going to offer a RAL or a RAC, you provide a schedule of fees. Nothing about this legislation dictates how you set your fees, but it must be displayed so the customer has a good sense of what they will ultimately pay by using these products. With that, I appreciate the time that you've given me to speak to this. I urge your support for House Bill 3640, and thank you very much.
Co-chairs, member of the committee, my name is Ron Wagner. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Board of Tax Practitioners. We are a consumer protection agency. We protect consumers by assuring that anyone who prepares tax returns for a fee is competent and ethical in their business practice. Oregon law requires paid preparers to be licensed by the board. The exception, as Representative Air Brewer mentioned, is CPAs and attorneys. The professionals are governed by the Board of Accountancy and the State Bar. As Consumer Protection Agency, my concern is that our licensed tax practitioners are the most competent and ethical tax preparers in the nation, which we believe they are, and that they provide a service to the taxpayers, that is in the taxpayers' best interest and provides full disclosure to the taxpayers. Filing tax returns is required by law. It's a legal requirement. We just finished that season, of course. When a taxpayer believes that their own tax situation is too complicated for them to prepare their return themselves, they may choose to solicit the services of a tax professional or one of our licensees. By choosing to use a tax practitioner, they are turning over all their financial and personal information, putting all trust in that person. Their trust includes not only that the tax returns will be prepared accurately, but that they are receiving the best financial advice, that which is in their best interest. As it is the will of the federal legislators and you, our state legislators, to provide financial assistance to lower-income families and individuals, it is hopeful that those who are paid to assist them to complete their tax returns help them receive the largest tax refund that the law allows. Taxpayers should also have available to them, after proper expenses to prepare the returns, as much of the tax refund to which they are entitled without incurring unnecessary or excessive expenses. RALs and RACs can be used, be a useful tool for some taxpayers, for those who are unable or who choose not to have bank accounts, or those who have a need to have the access to the funds more quickly than it is possible through electronic filing or direct deposit. As a consumer protection agency, I stress that when RALs and RACs are offered, it is imperative that full disclosure is provided to the taxpayers. This includes disclosure of the APRs defined under federal law, the actual total true cost to the taxpayer, and alternatives available by waiting a few days to receive refunds using electronic filing and or direct deposit. This should not be similar to the process of buying a house. My guess is most of you probably have purchased a house where you sit down at closing and you're handed a pile of papers, told to sign an initial, it could be 30 pages of documents without ever knowing or understanding what you are signing, just to meet the disclosure requirements of the title company. We will support any changes made by House Bill 3640. As the director of the board, we're in support of it and believe that it will provide consumers with the protection that they deserve. And certainly be more than happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Berger, members of the committee. I'm Sarah Holtzclaw for the record with Partnership End Poverty in Central Oregon. It's the intention of the partnership to minimize the barriers that low-income people face every day and to be the voice of those who cannot speak for themselves. I've come to ask for your support for House Bill 3640. House Bill 3640 is about protecting our most vulnerable consumers through transparency. Tax refunds for low-income taxpayers are a critical lifeline. Refunds are used immediately to pay rent, utility and daycare bills, car repairs, and the like. Filers are desperate for the refunds to get back on track financially. Getting their refund as quickly as possible is imperative, and thus the attraction to refund products. Filing taxes, as we all know from recent experience, can be very daunting, but for low-income families, it's even more so. They're intimidated by the process, by the preparer, by the government, and by the very need to pay for the preparation. Add to this the confusing filing fees and the refund loan process, and that level of intimidation increases considerably. The toxic combination of desperation and intimidation creates a reaction of just sign on the bottom line. The posted notices required in House Bill 36 will help a tax filer take a second breath, look at the situation, and make a reasonable decision. Regardless of recent administrative rulings and risk managements by banks, where there is this desperation, there will be refund products. The working poor is big business across the country. Refund products were born out of the desperation and the very existence of that earned income tax credit, and they will continue to exist because of it. When we limited the payday loans in Oregon, we made a huge step in predatory lending. Refund products are also predatory. They will and are continuing to exist and will likely morph simply because there is profit in it. By example, in January of this year, Jackson Hewitt's stock rose at the very news that H&R Block's bank was ordered to stop refund loans. As I said, working poor is big business. My final point is that House Bill 3640 is not intended to put a burden on the tax practitioner, but to offer information to the public and the users of these products who are by far low income. The spirit of the law is to offer a point of comparison to tax filers so that they can understand the financial consequences of the fees being offered. We encourage you to send this bill to the floor as a due pass. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Berger.
Would you say again, your testimony, sir, on an interesting, but this product, RAL are going away by federal mandate. Is that my understanding? So there will be fewer of these. It wasn't clear, but your concern is the RACs that are the new product.
Co-chair Berger, Co-chair Barnhart, the actions at the federal level were a couple of fold. First off, the IRS decided to stop offering a service whereby they alert the lender on whether or not there's a lien against the tax refund. So it's the underwriting that has gone away, making the product more risky, making the FDIC say these products are too risky because there is no underwriting. Therefore, as your banking regulator, we want you to stop making these loans.
Got it.
I'll point out that the IRS has made similar administrative actions in the past. I believe it was 1994. It is in my testimony. And then reversed themselves. We saw a dip in refund anticipation loans when they made that action. Again, I believe it's 1994. And then they an increase in refund anticipation loans when they brought the product, when the IRS lifted its administrative rule. So it wasn't an act of Congress. There's nothing that's as solid as that happened at the federal level.
Okay, thank you. That was what I needed to understand. Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Matt Marquis, it looks like you're the only one signed up against. You get to carry the load.
Co-chairs Barnhart, Berger, members of the committee, Matt Marquis representing H&R Block today. Just a little bit of history on this issue. H&R Block, about 4 or 5 years ago, worked very closely with Senator Prezansky and then Representative Galizio and crafted a bill around refund anticipation loans that was a disclosure bill and actually does much of the disclosure, if not all of the disclosures that are in this bill, maybe written a little differently, but I think the point was the same. And that bill passed. Since then, we've had a very tight disclosure law on the books, probably one of the tightest disclosure laws in the nation, I would guess. This bill, as mentioned, really goes after three things: refund anticipation loans, refund anticipation checks, and then a requirement to post all of your tax preparation fees. As you've heard, refund anticipation loans, the federal government whether administratively or not, has really put a stop to refund anticipation loans. H&R Block did not offer this product at all this year. There were, I think through Jackson Hewitt and Liberty, you could get a refund anticipation loan, but the banks that offered those products by the end of this tax season, or I guess tax season's now over, really are being shut down and won't offer the product anymore. A refund anticipation check is really kind of a bad name for the product, I think, but there's no check that's actually transpired. What happens, you go in, you get your taxes prepared. If the fee is $150, let's say, and you don't have $150, this is a product that allows you to float that $150 fee until your tax refund comes in. In doing so, H&R Block charges one fee, $32.95. That is one fee that is used to set up a bank account. That's the only fee charged for the service. A bank account is set up in a joint bank account. The refund is put into that bank account. H&R Block then takes their $150. The rest of that then goes to the consumer. They have three options. They could get a check that day. If they get a check from that account, I think there is a fee for that. They can put it on what they call an Emerald card. There's no fee for putting it on an Emerald card. That is like a debit card. Their product has actually won awards from the federal government as to low fees and everything else. Or they can get that money transferred into their own account for no fee. So if they have their own bank account and they want it electronically transferred into that account, they can do so, no fee involved. So the only fee that we charge is that $32.95, and it is strictly for the setting up of that account. What this bill does is it tries to take that fee and tie it into an interest rate. And what's confusing for that is that with the Truth in Lending Act, we are required to disclose what our interest rate is. Under that form from the federal government, we show a 0% interest rate because there is no interest charged. Under the way this bill is written, that lender's fee of $32.95 for setting up that account would then try to be calculated into an interest rate, and we're going to be disclosing an interest rate. I couldn't even tell you exactly what it is. It would differ on everyone, I would presume. So the consumer is going to see two different disclosures, one from the federal government that shows zero, one from the state that says something else. It's going to be somewhat confusing, I believe, to the consumer. This also then puts a cap of 36%. It, I believe, tries to exempt out federally chartered banks because you cannot really restrict what a federally chartered bank does. But the way this is drafted is it says that a facilitator can't be licensed if they are charging or if they are offering a product over 36% interest rate. So the facilitator, the tax practitioner, could not actually get a license to offer this product if they're using a federally chartered bank at 36%. I'm not really sure how that plays, but I do know there's some cases that have been decided in the last few years that tax practitioner at the time that they're working offering that product is actually an agent of the federally chartered bank. So it's a little confusing yet how that would actually work. You heard that, you know, the refund anticipation loan is an administrative thing of how they got rid of it and it could change, but I would say that it's better to come from a federal government on an issue like this where we're trying to regulate banks as far as what they're doing as far as interest rates and products that they offer, because if you do it state by state, you can't get everybody, and so you're going to put some people not offering the product while the federally chartered banks are still going to offer that product. The last thing that this bill does is it requires, if you're offering any types of these products that we just discussed, to post all of your tax preparation fees. I can't speak to Jackson Hewitt or other types of companies, but at H&R Block we charge by the form. And so this would require us to post something that shows every single tax form and a fee associated with that. I'm not really sure how that helps the consumer, because when the consumer comes into H&R Block, they're not going to know which of those forms they're necessarily going to need. At H&R Block, when you get your taxes done, you come in, you sit down, you have a discussion, you go through it. Nobody is required to pay anything until they sign their tax return. After that time, then they would be liable for the fees that were disclosed to them prior to that. Oftentimes at H&R Block, the consumer would say, you know, I'm not happy with whatever, pick up their stuff and leave. There would be nothing charged at that time. There would be nothing owing. So I'm not sure that that's the best approach as far as posting all of those fees up front like that. The other thing I want to offer is that, or let you know, that H&R Block, if you file your taxes through H&R Block online, you can do so free of charge if you make $50,000 or less. We also offer all 1040 Easy forms in our offices free of charge. So if that's the only thing you're filing is a 1040 Easy, there is no charge, in which case a refund anticipation check then on either of those products would not even come into play, because the only purpose for that, again, is if you don't have the money to pay for your taxes that day. If it's a free product, there obviously wouldn't be. I could go on, but I know you have a long agenda. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much for coming up today. I pulled up the H&R Block website, and I'm noticing that it says you can get up to $9,999 fast in capital letters. And if I go down to the little asterisk on the bottom, it says that fast is the comparison based on receiving a check in the mail from the IRS. Can you tell me how much faster a consumer will receive a check? It says 8 to 15 days versus if they filed electronically and received the check directly from the IRS. What is fast in
you
terms
know,
of a number of days?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Gelser, I'm not exactly sure. I'll get back to you. I'm not sure what that product is. I know with the refund anticipation check, the timing of your refund does not come any quicker. It's not a speeded up process. So I'm not sure exactly what you're looking at online, but I'd be happy to get back to you. I can call and find out.
Mr. Chair, may I follow up?
Yes, please.
Thank you. I am looking at the page on H&R Block that's titled Federal Refund Anticipation Check, and it indicates that you will get your money faster than if you go the free route of having it come directly from the IRS with e-filing if you sign up for this Federal Refund Anticipation Check. So the advertising seems to be somewhat at odds with what you've just said.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, the only thing I can think of is if you don't have a bank account, that it potentially could come faster than if you were getting it mailed to you. And I would say that I can't speak to Oregon specifically, but on a nationwide, there is a very large percentage of taxpayers that do not have bank accounts. So I could see potentially, I'll have to check because I don't know, honestly. I'm going to check and I'll get back to you. But I suppose if a consumer did not have a bank account where they could get something electronically deposited from the IRS and you're setting up a temporary account, and then you could get that. So you would get that, you know, in 14 days or less, I would presume, versus 4 to 6 weeks.
Okay, thank you. And one further follow-up?
Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm also noticing in the advertising here that it specifically points out a couple of times receive up to $9,999 fast. And I'm wondering what percentage of people in Oregon are receiving a refund that large that would be going through a federal refund anticipation check, and what the average size is. When you're talking about many of these taxpayers not having a bank account, I'm wondering how many taxpayers that are getting a $9,999 refund would be sitting there without a bank account in order to receive that $10,000 minus $1 refund.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Gelser, I don't have that in front of me today, but I'll be happy to get it to you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Brewer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Markey, you mentioned that the fee for a refund anticipation check was going to be asked to be indexed into an interest rate. Can you show me in the bill where that talks about that?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Eric Brewer, I believe if you look at page 2, section 4, little b, starting on page 43, where it talks about the Truth in Lending Act, and then on line 45, you'll see, except that notwithstanding the definition set forth the annual percentage rate under the Act, the annual percentage rate that the licensee calculates and discloses under this section must include all fees that the lender charges in connection with the refund anticipation.
Loan,
yes.
Not check.
So this is not applied to, so the 36% cap does not, is your understanding that does not apply to the refund anticipation check?
This talks about the APR disclosure on the loan.
So if you look at right above that, section 1, little a, it's this section is on both refund anticipation payments, instruments, and refund anticipation loans. That's what our H&R Block attorneys read this, and that's how they interpreted it. If they're wrong, then we can certainly have that conversation.
Follow-up?
Please. Yeah.
So if that is troublesome on the fee for the $32.95 for a refund anticipation check, we could carve that out and ask that not to be put into an APR. Would that be troublesome to you and acceptable at that point?
You know, the one thing I, Mr. Chair, Representative Eric Brewer, the one thing I didn't mention is that right now the federal government, IRS, is actually looking at some of the folks' national organizations that preceded me in testifying today, at looking at offering this type of a service for free, whereas the IRS potentially would split up somebody's refund and send that $150, in my example, to H&R Block, send the rest of the refund to the consumer. And as they're looking at that, I think it might be a little premature to put something in our statutes without knowing what exactly the federal government is going to do in that area. And I don't know if they're going to do anything for sure or not, but it would be H&R Block's standpoint to wait and see what they do so that Oregon statute doesn't prohibit something that may be specifically allowed under the federal statute.
Thank you. Other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Robin Johnson, Sybil Hebb, Rick Bennett.
Good morning, Chairs Barnhart, Berger, members of the committee. I'm Robin Johnson, Community Advocacy Coordinator for the Oregon Hunger Task Force, and I want to thank you for this opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 3640. The Oregon Hunger Task Force views economic stability as the most effective way to permanently solve hunger in our state because we view hunger as an income issue. Hunger continues to affect far too many families with children, seniors, and individuals who struggle to get enough money in their pockets to pay their basic living expenses. As I'm certain all of you are aware, over 750,000 Oregonians rely on the SNAP program to meet their food needs each month. About one in two students in our state qualify for free or reduced price lunch at school. And still, about 240,000 Oregonians rely on emergency food boxes to eat each month. Therefore, a primary goal of our state's five-year plan to end hunger is to increase economic stability for families. This includes a strategy of reducing unfair and predatory lending practices such as refund anticipation loans and checks. These products unfairly target low-income people who are desperate to pay their rents, mortgages, to get back and forth to work, and essentially to buy food. This committee has the opportunity to help Oregonians keep more money in their pockets to meet expenses and still have money to buy food, and therefore the Oregon Hunger Task Force asks this committee to pass this bill with a due pass onto the floor. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you very much. Please.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here today also to offer support for House Bill 3640, and I appreciate very much the efforts of the sponsors and of this committee in looking at this important issue. As you know, the Law Center is a nonprofit law firm. Our mission is to help low-income Oregonians achieve access to justice and helping people to avoid predatory practices and fees that are unnecessary and maybe unknown to them is an important issue for us, especially in these times, our clients are struggling so much to make their basic meet their basic needs and make ends meet. I'll add only a few points to the pieces that others have offered before me, and I'll focus specifically on the refund anticipation checks because I believe those are the current greater instrument that's in use, although we have similar concerns about the refund anticipation loans if they do continue. But the refund anticipation check does charge a substantial fee for the privilege of receiving a deposit into a temporary account of the refund that is owed to taxpayers. And that fee is a large chunk of money essentially out for the pleasure of having or the privilege of having the tax electronic filing taken care of by the preparer. So if you look at the charge that's being passed on to the consumer for the benefit of having the taxes prepared, it would probably be less expensive for consumers to go get a payday loan in order to take out the money and pay for the tax preparation up front rather than to defer the payment of that and pay for it through the setting up of this temporary account at a bank account and having the check deposited there. And we just think that's not an appropriate way of handling these situations, and the consumers would be better off if they had the information that's provided to them as required under the bill in the disclosures, if they're able to make these decisions with information and they're better able to protect their assets and themselves. I just wanted to also clarify that, you know, in this situation, the risk in these loans is extremely low. It's a guaranteed deposit of a check from the U.S. Treasury. And so it seems that charging that much money for the preparation of these fees based on such a secure deposit is out of line. The only other issue I would add is that we think that the requirement that the tax preparers providing these instruments register and be subject to monitoring through the Department of Consumer and Business Services, or I'm sorry, through the Board of Tax Practitioners, is appropriate. Oversight of these practices makes, I think, everybody a little bit more careful, and it helps us to do a better job of understanding what problems may arise. So for those reasons, we are supportive of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair Barnhart, Chair Berger, members of the committee, for the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations, AARP Oregon. With consideration of your time, let me just say that I've provided a letter of support for the bill. As written, it is in keeping with AARP's principles and policies related to consumer protection. We would urge your support and passage of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a prohibition on page 5 against unconscionable activity, and I'm just curious what the Law Center thinks that is. There's that broad prohibition makes you think there must be something else that folks were concerned that's happening to require that type of a remedy or prohibition.
Co-chairs, Representative Bence, thank you for the question. I think our concern and what we've seen in the past, and we have less experience with the refund anticipation checks. They're a newer product, and so we don't have as much specific feedback. But what I can say is that I think where consumers have information that's presented to them that they don't understand or that don't clearly set out proposal is and what the contract is that the consumer would be entering into, we worry about the potential for manipulation. This happens a lot in cases where there's language discrepancies as well. We often see solicitation of business in one particular language and then the provision of information in a different language. And so our clients who may not have English as their first language may get more confused, and there's more potential for, we think, misleading negotiations. So I don't mean to suggest that any of the practitioners here in this room have been engaging in that, but that's what we worry about, and so that's one benefit, we think, to having that provision there.
Thank you.
Representative Berger.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Bennett. Does AARP provide any information, help, outreach at tax time to your members about warnings about possible dangers of some of these products?
Well, again, for the record, Rick Bennett, AARP Oregon. Chair Berger, AARP, through our foundation, has the tax aid program, which provides services related to filing of taxes for a number of people, certainly older tax filers. It's one of actually our largest programs related to volunteers participating with AARP. I cannot give you specific information related to the services provided, but if it's similar to other programs we participate in, I'm sure they do provide disclosure and representation as to the benefits of electronic filing. And I believe we do so without any fee attached to that.
Follow-up, if possible, I would find it useful to find out in Oregon specifically how much, how many volunteers provided some amount of time to your members on that. And it is open only to members or to any?
No, to any member of the public.
I'd be interested if you could email that to me and the rest of the committee.
Be happy to do so.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. That would be much appreciated. I will note in reference to the earlier question, there's a definition of unconscionable activity on page 7, line 31, for what it's worth. Other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3640. Colleagues, we have a number of work sessions scheduled for this morning. We're going to try to actually get a short discussion of two of them this morning, and so we'll, with that, we'll open a public hearing, I'm sorry, a work session on House Bill 2541 for the purpose of giving you a report on where things stand at the moment. While Mazin is coming, I might note that the issue that we're working on has to do with the revenue neutrality, and I think you may be prepared to give us a short explanation of where that stands at the moment. Is that right?
That's good. That's
okay.
Good. Correct, Mr. Chair. The bill, as you have, and at this time, the dash five. Amendment in your packet. At the time when we looked at those rates for the tax to become the new revenue neutral, in a way, replacing the federal tables that we have, that was a while ago, based on a set of data that at the time did not include full data for the years of 08 and 09. And of course, with the time, as you know, with this data, we have all kinds of different new additions and more completeness of that data. As we looked at that, the average or the 3-year average that was taken at that time, and we examined it against the data that we have updated today, it seemed like the revenue neutrality was not accomplished by the data that was based on, or the rates that based on the dash five. So in order to get to that, we've ran it through a number of the years of the data. So we averaged the 5 years going 05, 06, 07, 08, and 09, and came up with a different type of schedule. The schedule that you have on the table in front of you that says it is the last schedule in the right-hand column. That will be the new schedule that will accomplish the type of revenue neutrality that you were looking for. Of course, also on the table that I've put in front of you, you have also the effect of the three different types of rates. This is the current schedule versus the dash five and versus the new schedule. And the effective rates going from the $1 million estates up to 16.1, and if you notice in the middle column and the last one, the idea of the 16.1 actually becomes 14.6 million because of the 1.5 million exclusion. So the effective rates in one existing rate in the existing tables would be going from 3.3% up to 12.7%. Under the dash five, the effective rates will be actually zero at 1 million, and they start at the, 1.6 at 0.5 and go up to 14.7. And with the newly suggested rate, the goes from 0.7 to 15.7. Now, you would see that the flip point highlighted between the dash 5 and the new schedule at the point of where the inflection between the comparable rates and the current rate, you would have it at the 6.1 million estate. That's when the dash 5 would have come to about the same rate as current rates. That goes down in the table to about 3.6 under the new arrangement that is proposed for revenue neutrality. So that's what we and that is shown in the graph that you have underneath those tables. So once we apply these tables, we ran them again for the years 2002, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9, assuming that if this new rate would be in effect for these years versus the old tables and table B rates, the difference in the amounts of revenue that would have came out of that, it was up to 0.4%. I think that's probably as close as it gets. We can come closer if you want. But that's what I would suggest here. And it's worth mentioning, of course, although you would have the same expected value or the same revenue neutrality, if you will, this revenue neutrality or the expected value comes probably with a bigger variance. In other words, yes, you have revenue neutrality, but not necessarily the same type of stability. Well, it wasn't stable. It was volatile to start with. It is more volatile now because you have concentration on a less number of types, which are sometimes will come and sometimes they won't. Sometimes you would have people with that high level rates of states being taxed, some others not. So expected value and variance is so that's
thank you. Committee members, what you're hearing is a little bit of an echo of the conversation that we had in the work group over the predictability of revenue in any given biennium from this tax. I think my suspicion is that if you tried to figure out what it was going to be over 25 years, you'd probably be pretty accurate. Trying to predict it for any 1 year or any 2 years is probably pretty difficult because it means you need to predict who's going to die and how much money they've got. And that's pretty hard to do. Representative Berger.
Mazin, we have before us the dash nines.
Yes, Madam Chair, the dash nines, I believe, came to fix the applicability date for the 2010, as I understand it, from Council. It was requested, I believe, by members.
Are the changes in tax not reflected in the dash?
No, okay. the dash nine is for the applicability of the when the 2010 change of the federal.
So the schedule that would go in if we were to get a new dash with a new schedule would be the one that says new on it?
The one not on page 2 but in page 1, that would be the new
the one, page 1, which one?
Right, that one.
The one on the far right at the top?
The far right at the top.
Right. I see. That one. Got it.
Okay.
That's the
so
one.
So there's no tax above $11 million.
That will not probably be revenue neutral, Mr. Chair. But the idea is that the cutoff of the escalation, everybody after that pays the same rate.
Same rate.
Okay. Which means you're basically flattening the whole
thing.
All right. Colleagues, we have run out of time, as you can see, for this morning. We have, we're going to close the work session on House Bill 2541, and we're going to carry over all of the work sessions that we have on the agenda for today to Wednesday. Tomorrow, the Tax Credit Committee is meeting at 8:30, is that right? At 8:30?
Correct.
But we have one work session currently on the agenda for Wednesday. We will now have seven. Given that we have, there's only one of these bills is actually ready to work. There may be another one ready to work on Wednesday, but we have a lot of discussion to have. So please be here at 8 o'clock so we have a quorum so we can open a work session and get to work on these with seven of them to come. That allows for about 15 minutes each, and I suspect that at least for some of these we're going to need more time than that. Anything else, Paul? Have I given the required notice? I have. All right. With that, the committee is adjourned. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.